Talk Show.
Recorded live.
Hey, everybody. It's Tracy Brown from Stained Glass Spirit, and I am excited that you've decided to invest an hour of your time thinking about and talking about and listening about this idea of being intentionally inclusive. Intentionally Inclusive is a program hosted by Stained Glass Spirit, and our goal was really simple. Let's create a library of conversations that anyone who is interested in being more inclusive or interfacing more effectively with diversity and having that be a part of a positive part of their culture in a spiritual community would have this library, this podcast, this library of conversations to listen to reflect upon. And so I am talking to all kinds of people from a wide variety of spiritual communities about what it means and what it takes to be intentionally inclusive as a leader in a spiritual community. I'm talking to ministers, I'm talking to licensed practitioners, licensed unity teachers, chaplains, and lots of lay people who serve in leadership roles so that we can get a well-rounded approach and lots of practical insights. What I hope you will feel as you listen to today's conversation and all the others is that you just got to eavesdrop on a candid conversation between me and one or two other people about lessons we've learned about diversity and inclusion and ideas that have worked and sometimes ideas that didn't work. And that's how we learned that we don't want to do that again. If you've not visited stainedglassspirit.net, I encourage you to do so, not only for the updates and the most recent information about intentionally inclusive, but also because we update the blog on our homepage at that website typically 6 or 7 times a month, a couple times a week, and we will post ideas and resources and information that will help you match your commitment or support your commitment to both diversity and inclusion. But today, I'm all focused on intentionally inclusive, and I get the honor and the privilege of chatting with Reverend Dr. John Waterhouse. Now, most people who know Dr. John know him as the elected president of Centers for Spiritual Living. And as the president for that organization, he, of course, interfaces with and represents more than 440 spiritual communities all over the globe. A lot of people know Dr. John as the senior co-minister of Center for Spiritual Living Asheville in North Carolina. But what many don't realize is that even if he were not Dr. John from a ministerial perspective, he would still be Dr. John because he has an earned academic PhD. He also has a very interesting business background. He's a certified firewalk facilitator, and he's lived in Florida, he's lived in Texas, he's lived in Australia, and he's lived in North Carolina, and he may have lived other places, but I know just in those 4 locations, every one of them is so different from the other. So I want to welcome you, John, to Intentionally Inclusive.
Thank you, Tracy. It's an honor to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So I want to start in a place that may not seem so intuitive, because I'm guessing that now as president of Centers for Spiritual Living, everybody always starts with that and what's going on with CSL and what are you doing as president? But I want to start with the fact that you've lived in at least 4 very distinct and different places, Florida, Texas, Australia, and North Carolina. And I'm curious, just thinking about in the places you've lived, what is it that you know is absolutely true about diversity and inclusion?
Well, you find that in different places, people have different ways of expressing their process of creating relationships. And living in South Florida, of course, had the experience of a very strong Hispanic influx during my childhood, watching the Cuban population descend upon South Florida and watching how people reacted to that. When I lived in Texas, certainly there was a strong Mexican influence, and not as overpowering, because Houston was a growing city, very much dynamically driven by the oil industry, but there was that sense of a cultural divide between communities. When I lived in Australia, it was very different. It was the sense of relationship with the indigenous people of Australia seemed to be a very reasonable, kind thing between the Caucasian population and the indigenous population. So I didn't feel much of that. If there was any sense of resistance to anything, it was the idea of people coming from England and America. Those seem to be less acceptable relationship building attitudes around those things than there was across any kind of racial divide. And then living in the South has been a real mixed bag, because I really do live in an oasis of progressive thinking in Asheville, North Carolina. But because we have had a very diverse experience here. I have only on very special occasions, distinct occasions, experienced anything that could be construed as racist or not being sensitive or open to a broad sense of diversity. And I don't even need to talk about those things. But I do know in the South that has been a slow go for many generations. And I've watched that and actually participated at some level in those kinds of social experiments and experiences. So it really has given me, as I have over the 60 years of my life lived in these different places, a real sense of broadening my perspective on how human beings interact across the lines of their differences.
Thanks for that. I wanted to start there because it's true that our geography, our national origin, of course, our geography, what part of the country or world we live in, it really does influence how we see the world and how we experience the world seeing us. And sometimes it is about race. And sometimes it's about class, and sometimes it's about profession. I mean, there are so many ways that our differences can either bring us together or create barriers. And sometimes, you know, people just immediately jump on race or ethnicity and think that's the only thing we need to talk about, or that's the only thing to talk about when we talk about diversity. So I invited you to be a part of this series of conversations, having no idea whether you would say yes or no, and trying not to be attached, even though I wanted you to say yes, yes, yes. So I am curious, what made you say yes, and, you know, what is it about this topic that interests you?
Well, I'm going to be absolutely honest with you that the strongest thing that compelled me to say yes was that you were the one asking, because I really hold you in very high esteem as a colleague in the leadership of our spiritual organization. I have worked with you, and even though we have not spent massive amounts of time, my experience over time has been that you're an extraordinary presence, that you're a clear thinker, that you ask compelling questions, and I have always been impressed. So the idea of spending an hour with you on the phone, whether or not somebody else would be listening, was deeply interesting to me.
I am just sitting here saying, Tracy, the only thing you're supposed to say is thank you, thank you, thank you. I receive my good. I receive the compliment. I'm taking it in. And so, yes, thank you for that. And I invited you knowing that you would have some very interesting perspectives to share about this topic from experiences that a lot of people don't even know that you may have had. Like, we could start anywhere, but let's start with you sharing, what's your doctorate degree in?
Good. That's where I wanted to go. My doctorate is in organizational psychology, and in the process of getting that degree, I did an internship that was wonderfully compelling. It was with a man named Forrest Toms. Dr. Forrest Toms got his PhD from Howard University. He was this just this amazing presence. He would walk into a room, and other than the fact that he was taller than most of the people in the room, he had this magnetic presence that drew your attention to him, that charismatic presence that some people have. And he was this extraordinary teacher, and his work was in diversity training. And he was a corporate and a business trainer. And when I met him, it was through an entirely, in fact, I'll tell you how I met him. We were both invited to participate in an event at the Crystal Cathedral in Garden Grove, California. And it was a symposium on youth violence in America. And we struck up a conversation. I saw what he was doing, and when I knew that it was my job to find someone to lead me through an internship, I asked him to do that, and he agreed. And the project we worked on was with the Wake County School District, which is Raleigh, North Carolina. And he invited me to come over and do this study and to do some training in there. And it was really about how that school district was dealing with issues of diversity within the structure of the school district's organization. And we found some remarkable things as we did our study. And as I saw the methodologies that he used and the way he structured that, and then had the opportunity to do some training with the administrators and teachers in that district and other members of the staff, we just did some amazing work. And I learned some of the nuances, along with the training material that really pointed out how blind so many, and this is not in any way to diminish our ability as Caucasian Americans to see, to know that we are actively involved in creating a better world. We are. However, we have blind spots. And this was an opportunity for us to show some blind spots, because very few people these days walks around and says, I'm a racist. Nobody wants to be a racist. Even the owner of the LA Clippers doesn't want to be a racist. Mm-hmm. It's not fashionable to hold those thoughts, yet all of us hold something that keeps people at a distance. And it doesn't matter whether it's racial or ethnic or religious or whatever, that we are unwilling to engage that. And this was an opportunity to do that. And one of the things that actually my part of the research program showed was that everybody in the maintenance hierarchy of that school district fell into two categories, the workers and management. And the workers were all people of color, and the management were all white people. And nobody had noticed that. Mm-hmm. At least they claimed they hadn't. And of course, that created changes, and it was amazing to me that we could use some scientific methodology to actually show something that was so evident if you were just looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
And it helped. It was a helpful thing. And there were those individuals, as we did the training, that resisted it and said, I have nothing in me that is in any way discriminating. And yet, they did. We all do. So the idea of just fessing up and then looking at it and shifting it is such a worthwhile project for all of us. And so that's what I got out of my doing that work for a doctorate. That was really one of the shining gems of my training and my learning in that work.
Yeah, that's really powerful, because the reality is we couldn't survive as a human being in terms of just getting through our day if our mm-hmm. brain wasn't set up to discriminate, to discern A yeah. from B from C. And so the idea that we don't do that with people when we do that with everything else is absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
But when we tell ourselves we don't do that, or when we, you know, we're so afraid, you know, we don't want a quote-unquote negative label, racist, homophobic, sexist, mm-hmm. whatever the label is, then we basically refuse to look at what we're doing or creating, and so then it begins to run us instead of us managing it. So
I love
that. That's a great example of, yeah, and to be able to, like you said, that how could people work together in an organization and not notice what was, in this case, visually available to them?
Yes.
Yeah.
Another piece that I learned in there that just I can't help but want to talk about it for a moment is that so many people in any society that has a majority and then minorities, anytime where that's it, I mean, there are still societies in the world that pretty much try to keep themselves pure. The minority is everybody. There's nobody else. It doesn't work real well anymore. But in most cases where that exists, the majority thinks that any kind of challenges are the challenges of the minority.
Mm-hmm.
And that by holding it that way, to think that racism is a black problem, or that sexism is or homophobia is a gay problem, is totally twisting the picture. And one thing that Dr. Tom said to me when we were doing some of that training was, he said, "I need you. I need you because you're a white guy, and because you get it, and because when you say it to white people, they hear it differently than when I say it to them as a black man. They hear me speaking towards something that is in my interest, where you're speaking, saying something is in your interest when most people don't see it that way. And that you might get their attention in a way that's more effective than me," even though he had all the experience and all the, you know, all the credentials and all the background and all the years of study and research and all. He had all of that, so he came in really strong. But he said, "I need you to be in there doing this," or people will just simply set it aside and say that wasn't about me.
Right. It's really easy to dismiss as, oh, that's self-serving. And I know I've experienced that, and as well that for some people it's really critical to hear it from someone who looks like them or someone who is in the majority group. So I've done the same thing for my friends who are gay, lesbian, bisexual, mm-hmm. or transgender, whereas a heterosexual woman to be able to say, you know, this isn't right, or I'm noticing this, or let's consider, you know, this other idea, and to have people look at me and say, "Well, I didn't know you were gay," and I'm like, "Well, I'm not, but we still need to pay attention to this," and have them look at me like, "Well, why are you even bringing it up if it's not your quote unquote your issue,
well, right?
My issue is that everyone is treated fairly and given an opportunity to bring their talents forth and to succeed. That's my issue. So it's not limited to race or gender or sexual orientation or, you know, some individual identity.
Yeah. And it's what I've discovered over these years of having these kinds of conversations is that people think that, well, let me say it this way. We're all wired in a way that we have a level of comfort with people that look and sound and act like us. And we have a level of discomfort when we are surrounded by people that have very different customs or attitudes. I mean, you know, you can step into it in a way that you're the guest and everyone is very kind to you. And even though everybody's different, you feel important. And those are nice. And that's when your ego takes over your natural desire to be in an environment where sameness is highly present. So, but in most cases, I remember I'm really on Forrest Toms right now. He invited me to a dinner at his home. And I was so delighted to go there. And everybody that was there was African American but me.
Mm-hmm.
What an evening. It was compelling. It was intellectual. It was delicious. The food was amazing. And when I left, I was exhausted because I wasn't used to that.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't accustomed to being in an environment that was so different from my comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so good for me to do that because now in life I seek that out. I want to be in that environment that is different, that is causing me to stretch myself. And that's, I think, the thing that we get from inclusiveness, even though it's harder work. It's not as easy as being in a room of sameness. It's richer. It's more powerful. It's more compelling. And it causes us to stretch and ourselves into something greater.
Yeah, and that's a really great observation. In fact, I would put it under something that everyone who wants to create an inclusive community needs to understand that, you know, it takes intention and it takes energy and there's rewards that come out of it that you can't get to any other way.
No other way. You're absolutely right. There's no other way to do it but simply to do it and to do it with your heart open and your mind open to experience everything that you can. And again, it's not easy. It's, you know, they've done studies with children. And even though some kids could care less how different the other kids they're playing with are, the tendency is, even in toddlers, to gravitate to people, to other toddlers that look like them. It's kind, there's something in us that does that. And it's probably fits into the ego, you know, because we hear so much about don't let your ego take over. Well, we have this natural thing, and the ego's structure is for protection. It's to protect us.
Mm-hmm.
From, you know, it's like your ego's there to say, hey, bud, you're really not up to this. Don't even try. And we'll back off because we want to protect ourselves. And that's really a basic function of ego. And my guess is this gravitation to sameness is part of the ego. And people that aren't into that can stretch beyond that and not let that be part of their persona, obviously they move very much more quickly into a greater sense of a broadness of life experience, where when we listen to that and react to that, we fall into a bit of a rut, and we carry it into our adulthood, and then we think we should hire people that think like us. And look like us, and we think that we should socialize with people like that. And you know, but then of course there's the pressure of social structure now, and we really need to have a couple of friends that are different, but not a majority of them, because then we'd have to really work. But what I found is that when I'm in environments that broaden these and stretch us out of these natural tendencies into something greater, it's an evolutionary step for anyone and everyone that does it.
Yeah. There's a, you mentioned a study and it triggered my memory. There's some research that's been done and repeated like every 5 years for more than 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually had a control group, of course, and, you know, other groups. And they took people who were very different in identity ways, key identity ways, and they put them, you know, together with to accomplish a task. So at first they had homogeneous groups, and they, you know, said, okay, this is how long it takes, and you get X number of usable results. And then they had mixed groups and put them to work together, and they took twice as long and to come up with half of the viable options or, you know, things to do. And then they took mixed groups and explained diversity in terms of three or four different key aspects of communication style and that are affected by culture and cultural norms, and just gave them that information. And they came up, compared to the original control times and numbers, with twice as many viable options. And it was because once they in a shorter period of time, so once they realized, oh, yes, we are different, we know we're different, and there are advantages to these different cultural ways of showing up, then instead of fighting and trying to get everybody to, you know, do it their way, they actually began to say, oh, okay, well, I see you're coming from a different place. I never thought of it that way. Explain it to me more how that would work. You know, and then it'd be like, I'm open to it because I see you're not challenging me. You just have different experiences that give you a different view and a different set of possible solutions. And when I reviewed that study, it was just fascinating to me. And then I thought about groups I've been a part of. When I'm the only one who's African-American, or when I'm the only one who's a woman, it seems that people are not threatened by it, but they're also not particularly interested in a different perspective. They're like, oh, come on, you're welcome to be a part of us. Just kind of fit in.
Do it our way.
Right. Get in where you fit in, and, you know, but don't expect us to do anything any different. And then, you know, I've been in groups where there's more of, you know, there's more difference, and the people who are in the majority are feeling threatened by it. And then there are even more, no, this is the way we do it. You know, you got some other ideas, forget about that, get in line. And then when you have people who really are, you know, ready to be leaders and ready and or have good information, there's so much more sharing, and the outcomes are so different, and often so much better.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so I love that, and I absolutely agree that it takes people who are in the majority needing to speak up about what is possible and what may be being missed.
Yeah, absolutely, and giving compelling reasons why this is important. And it's not, you know, I think a lot of people think why it's important is because we don't want to be somehow portrayed in a way that's not flattering. You know, we're always, it's like politicians, they're always wanting to look good. We're always all wanting to look good. But there are times when we need to transcend that and take advantage of the blessing before us that we can't see. It's like an invisible blessing. And it's invisible because it could be a problem. It could be a challenge. It could require more effort. You know, and those are not valid reasons not to get something better out of life. And frankly, when you have people with different life experiences, different cultural norms, different ways of thinking, you know, it all brings things to the table. And if you're not doing that, then you're picking a pauper's meal out of a banquet table.
Yes. So I'm curious about you've owned businesses. You've worked in oil and gas, the oil industry, and you've been a minister of a thriving spiritual center. I mean, are those two things very similar, or are they very different? They seem very different to me on the surface.
I have to tell you, I am very different. The one that was in the oil industry was in his 20s, was a gung-ho, going to be a millionaire, going to make it thing. And I think the reason I did that in hindsight is to understand the purpose of money. and to understand how it fits into the fabric of one's life. I did not understand that. I grew up in a working class family, and when I somehow managed with no sense to how to do it, ended up having my own business, it was a bizarre circumstance. And the money really, what I realized was money really does not make you happy. Not that it's bad. There's nothing bad about money. Money's wonderful, but it's not the source of life. It's a measurement. It's an agreement. It's an exchange, but it's not the thing that drives me and gets me up in the morning. That's what I thought it was back then. And when it all crumbled back in the 1980s, when the oil industry collapsed, and my business went away and my millions went away, I was asked by a business consultant, do you want us to save this business? And it came out of my mouth faster than I could think it. I said, no. Because I knew there was something else to do in life that was better. Mm-hmm. And when I left that, I dabbled around for a while, thinking I should stay in Texas. And then I decided, no, my life has fallen apart. My marriage is over. Everything that was important to me is gone. I'm in bankruptcy. I'm done. I'm out of here. So I went as far away from that place as I possibly could. I went to the opposite side of the planet, which is Australia. Remember when we were kids, they said if you dug a hole through the planet, you go to China? That's not true. You go to Australia. And the thing that helped with that was they spoke a form of English.
Yes.
So I didn't have to learn a language there. So I thought I would go down there and spend the rest of my life. As it turned out, I began my spiritual quest, found my first spiritual teacher, and began to awaken to who I was. And it was quite a different thing to move from there. And after being down there and experiencing some extraordinary things for a year, I came back to the United States, and it took me all of 3 days to find my first Science of Mind Center.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was no time at all. I came back and I was saying, the United States saying, nobody in my country has any of this information about, I had no idea how if there was anything metaphysical going on in the United States. And it was just a sign on the side of a road in front of a nice building, a nice campus. But the sign only said Science of Mind. The other sign said Center for Positive Living, blah, 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 blah. That did nothing for me. Science of Mind, what is that? So I pulled in and went in the office on a Thursday or Friday, and said, what is Science of Mind? And the woman that had come out to greet me explained something. It didn't register. I don't remember what she said, but she said, come on Sunday. And I had been, I grew up in a Baptist environment, and I was very comfortable in church, except that I was told that I was a hopeless sinner, and it's lost its lock on me over the years. And then I'd learned what I learned in Australia about being a spiritual being and really having a total control over my experience for the first time. Never been told that, and so I said, sure, I'll come on Sunday. And sure enough, that was it. They were talking my language, and I never left.
It was the perfect time.
Yes, the timing was impeccable. It was indeed.
So when you think about your experience in spiritual communities from that point going forward, what stands out for you or what comes to mind for you as maybe a tip or an observation about what makes diversity work or what let's go with the title of the whole podcast. What happens when a leader is intentionally inclusive, like either what that looks like or what happens in their own behavior?
Well, the first thing you have to learn as a leader is to overcome that quiet, demure, and insidious desire to surround yourself in sameness. It's there. It's there very naturally, and somebody comes in and you resonate with them because they are like you, because they think like you. And you draw those people, and when you speak on Sunday, you speak in terms that makes all those people feel comfortable. And then what you end up with is a very small, tight, loving but very tight and very limited community of a handful of people, and you don't have any idea why it didn't work. But if you're conscious that that would be a natural inclination, you intentionally do it differently, and you go out of your way to include people that will bring a different dimension to the table, so that you include them in leadership, you include them in studies, you make sure that broad-based appeal is there. You make sure that there are different points of view. You make sure that the conversation in classes doesn't get standardized, that it brings in things that are real for some people that other people don't think about. And even though that may make the people that don't think about it a little uncomfortable to have to think about it for a few minutes during a class, it brings value and it causes people to open up a little bit. I have had, since I've been president of CSL, I have had conversations with people that are uncomfortable with a minister talking about their sexual orientation. And that they really don't want their children to be in the room to hear that conversation. And I think, well, bless your heart that you are so stuck being unwilling to talk about things that are deeply important to people and to hear about them and to engage in them and to have a place in your heart to see that those people need to be at the table too. And they can be leaders of spiritual communities, and they can be prayer practitioners for you, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that you can gain value in your life in having a meaningful relationship with someone that is very, very different than you. Wow. I mean, what a wonderful idea. I remember the first class that I took in Science of Mind, we had prayer partners. And I had this lovely lady, and she was a Caucasian woman, young. She was a martial artist and a black belt in karate. I think it was karate. I don't really remember. But the fascinating thing that happened with that was that she had, when we were prayer partners, she had just come back from living in Japan for a time to do her deep work in this martial art that was her passion. And we were treating for each other, and I asked her to treat for some new clothes for me, because I'd just come back from Australia and I really needed to up-level my wardrobe. And it was weird that week that we were treating, I went to the local mall and went shopping and left that mall with a bathrobe that looked like a kimono, and it had Japanese symbols on it, and. Not until I got home did I realize what had happened, that her consciousness had influenced me in a wonderful way. I mean, I loved that robe. I wore it till it was tattered. But it influenced me in a way that I would not have otherwise probably had any interest. And when we meld our consciousness with people that are different than us, we get these neat little things that open us up to see the world in a different way. And when we converse with people that are different than us and get past those things that, well, I don't understand what you're saying, or this just doesn't resonate with me. Stay with it. There's something wonderful happening. And you're not going to get that blessing unless you're willing to let your guard down a little bit and loosen up a little bit and be okay with something that's really different than you. I mean, if you spend any time, one of my favorite people on the planet is Nirvana Gale, and Nirvana Gale is a teacher in Los Angeles. He comes from a background of education in the inner city, and he is a genius in that world, in that environment. And I have seen that man turn situations around with people in our movement that required such finesse. But when he's speaking, he speaks in a lingo that isn't normal for most of us, and we can give up on it. And I will just sit in the room and listen to that man all day, because I'll walk away with something that I couldn't find anywhere else in my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's when we can move into that way of embracing life, embracing the differences and including them in our experience, it only enriches who we are.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And often what happens is the person who is in the quote-unquote minority by numerical standards, let alone societal perspective, but you know they're really multicultural, so they're so used to adapting, you know, that it's become second nature to adapt and to go back and forth and to be authentic in that, not to be fake or phony. But when you grow up and you are, or even if you don't grow up a part of the majority, but you become accustomed to being a part of the majority or a part of the team that defines, for example, what the spiritual community is like, then you get so comfortable, it's easy to forget that you grow too when you are. It may feel like you're being challenged, but all growth comes with some discomfort.
Absolutely. By its nature, growth requires pressing against something and something pressing against you.
Exactly.
You know, that's the nature of growth. And when you, kids have growing pains. They're real things. Your body aches because it's growing so quickly.
Yeah.
And your mind does the same thing.
Right, and we know that intellectually, but it's funny how easy it is to forget that when we are dealing with people. So one of the things that I talk about a lot is the diversity welcome factor. So what is it that we do when we meet people into our, you know, when people are coming into our spiritual community? What does it have to do with our mission? Like, how does diversity affect that? And then I also talk about our inclusion worship factor and how are we including people in the message, in the music, and in the way we create a sense of membership in our Sunday service or in our classes or when people gather in our communities. So I'm just curious, and I know you've probably not heard either of those terms before, diversity welcome factor or inclusion worship factor, but is there anything that comes to mind that you've experienced in the centers you've been in or in growing CSL Asheville that you realize you actually have made some adaptations to the music or in the way that you deliver your message or what you do to have the community feel inclusive, even though there are lots of different kinds of people?
Well, you have to have, I think, that the word diversity is starting to get branded in a way that some people resist it automatically. Mm-hmm. So I like the idea of using the term inclusivity more. I think that's where we're headed, because that was the point of diversity, was to be inclusive in a very diverse manner. But I like that we're doing that. You have to have some music that hits different levels of enjoyment for different people. You have to kind of cause some people to stretch when you want to get a little more rockish with your music, or sometimes we just, you know, blow the roof off, and some people that makes the, you know, make them a little uncomfortable. And sometimes we have very gentle, beautiful music that, you know, piano music or something that is nice. And if you keep that variety going, it kind of lends itself to the idea that that you don't fall into a rut of doing the same kind of thing all the time. I mean, like this Sunday we did Happy, which was the big thing for Easter, I know, except that we have our music coordinator sounds like Pharrell Williams, and that is so cool. But then we'll have other kinds of music. We had Robin Fink, who is a guitarist with Nine Inch Nails and Guns N' Roses, come and do a ballad for us one Sunday when he was in town. You know, so we've had the full range of experience from very what is the word for high-minded you know, sophisticated music, you know, that kind of stuff, orchestration. And then we've had very, very, jump up and down, you know, dancing in the aisles type stuff. And I think keeping it different and not falling into any certain way provides that sense of we're going to touch everybody's life here. Somebody's going to have a day where they're just on top of the top of the clouds because something in that music touched them in a different way. So I think that's important. We have our practitioners. We have a fair amount of diversity. We have certainly age and sexual orientation and race and things of that sort. And by having our practitioners come up and do spiritual mind treatments on Sunday, we have a lovely variety of personality and temperament of those that come forward. And you just really have to give voice to the idea. I mean, there's some days where the topic really falls into this. The conversation, especially living in North Carolina, where there has been talk about discrimination of people of same-sex relationships as far as marriage and things of that sort, that comes up. And we don't go into politics here, but we do talk about spiritual principle related to our culture and to help people. Because we have conservatives in the room, we have liberals in the room, and we have people that are neither in the room. So you have to, I find that you really just have to stay on principle with people, and that creates an inclusive environment where everyone feels welcome.
Love that. What you just triggered for me was the reminder that if the people will expect whatever pattern you present. So if you are presenting a pattern mm-hmm. over time, if someone comes to your center for 3 months or 6 months and the music is always the same, and then you try to introduce something that's really different, then it's harder.
Yeah.
But if your pattern is a pattern of always changing it up, then changing it up becomes the pattern, and everybody knows, oh, I really didn't like that music. It was too loud, but it was only, you know, one part of the service, and that only happens, you know, every 3 weeks.
Right.
And next week, it's going to be something really reflective and quiet and meditative, like what I prefer. And yeah, it's the pattern has to become, it's always changing.
Mm-hmm. And there's something about that. You know, there really is something about opening people up to the possibility that it being different, at any level in any part of the human experience, being different is not a negative. It may not be my favorite, but it certainly is something that's going to touch me in a different way, and that's good for me.
Right. So I'm paying attention to the time, and of course, you know, we could probably chat and visit for a long time, many hours, not just one, around this topic. And I'm really clear that I'm not asking you to be a part of this conversation as the president of Centers for Spiritual Living. At the same time, you are the president for the Centers for Spiritual Living. So we're going to spend 5 minutes only.
Okay.
And anything that you might want to share related to your official role as president for Centers for Spiritual Living that you've noticed or that you admire, appreciate, or that you see as our growing edge as it relates to diversity and inclusion in Centers for Spiritual Living?
Well, the thing that comes to mind first and foremost is that we're in a process right now. Our organization is just over 2 years old. And although we have a 100-year tradition, or we're approaching 100 years, our organization being reorganized following the integration of two organizations that taught the same exact principles but were structured differently, coming together as one organization. We're only 2 years old, and so we're still in that, we're in the toddler stage. I hadn't thought of that until right now, but we're in the toddler stage. And one of the things that's happening with our organization is we're saying we have some priorities here, and we want a plan for achieving some reasonable goals around these priorities. And I'm very delighted that when our leadership council looked at what those could be, they came up with a series of them. Some of them are no-brainers: education, youth, communications, and then they fall into some other things. But the one that is that fits perfectly right here is that we said diversity is one of our top priorities. So we have a diversity commission in our organization, and that commission, working as a development team, has created a plan for us for 20 years, for 5 years, and for 2 years. And I've just received it and haven't even consumed it all yet. But that will fit and be brought into the fabric of a organization-wide strategic plan that will speak to all of the priorities that I mentioned and others. In this way, diversity will blend itself into every aspect of who we are, how we learn the principles that we live by, how we structure ourselves, how we are inclusive at every level of our organization, and to see what that means and how we can do that. And that, to me, is very exciting. So we're starting off well. And although certainly there have been bumps along the road in these couple of years, we knew that would be the case. And, you know, things are always up for review and reconsideration. But right now, I'm very excited about being involved in putting this strategic plan together. And I am deeply, deeply gratified that our organization sees this idea of diversity and inclusivity as such a high priority in who we are as an organization, because we are a model for the world. We may still be a small organization looking at how religious organizations in the world are, but we're 100 years old. And if you look at the thousands of year old religions in the world, wow, wouldn't they love to be able to be, from their inceptions, be looking at things that we're looking at. So I feel like we're in the perfect place right now as we look forward into the next couple of decades and to see where we want to be and how we want to be making a difference in the world as a spiritual organization.
Great. And the Diversity Commission is doing some really exciting things. So as president, you get to see what's happening now and what's going forward, and it is great that it is the commitment to diversity and inclusion is being wrapped into the overall strategic plan for the entire organization. So we have a few minutes left, and I guess what I just took a deep breath, and what came up for me was I don't want to miss the opportunity to have you say specifically to, I mean, people from Unity, from Centers for Spiritual Living, from Divine Science, from Christian organizations. There are a wide variety of people who are listening to this podcast, so it's not
That's
only
wonderful.
Science of mind, but someone who is a leader, whether they're staff or whether they are a minister or a practitioner or a lay person who is the team leader for pastoral care, what one or two things would you say to them, what challenge would you set for them to be inclusive?
I learned a lesson a few years ago, it happens to be kind of racially focused, but it was a good one. So one of my passions over the years has been men's consciousness work. And the very first men's gathering I ever went to, it was a diverse group, and there were a number of people of different orientations and different races and such in the group. But there were two men specifically that stood out to me. One was a black man that had struggled with his life and spoke from that place of the struggle. And I was wowed by him. And there was another man who was also African-American, but his demeanor and his way of being present felt very white. And I made that man wrong for about a day and a half. I made that man wrong for the way he was being. And I didn't understand in the moment what I was doing, But after about a day and a half, he came to me and he said, "Why are you treating me so poorly? I can see it in your eyes. I hear it in your words. Why are you treating me this way?" And I had to go sit with myself and see what's the problem here. And I was being prejudiced against a man for the way he wanted to be in the world, which had nothing to do with me. It was him. And for me to in any way reject him was a loss for me, which is what I found again and again in my life. So my job in life now, when I am in face-to-face with another person, is to not try to fit them into a box, not try to make them the way I think they should be, but to be absolutely present with them and let them be the most important person in the world to me as we talk, even whether it's for a minute or a moment or for a day. It doesn't matter. If I'm with them, they are bringing the presence of the divine reflected into my life in a way I've never seen before. This is a mirror that is a different mirror than I've ever been with before. So my job is to be open and present, to wrap my energy around this one and to be present with who they are in the world, because they've brought me a gift and it's my job to find the gift. And they may be coming to me telling me their life has fallen apart and they don't know what to do and they're lost, but that doesn't matter. They've brought me a gift, and my job is to see it and to reject anything less than that, to see the presence of the divine before me. And when I am able to do that, I win. And hopefully I am a good reflection for them in some way as well. So that, as a leader, as a teacher, as a minister, that's the most important thing, is to never, ever, ever let my limiting thoughts get in the way of seeing God in someone else.
Amen. And that, I think, is a great way for us to wind down Unintentionally Inclusive today. I know that everyone who listens to this recording already has a commitment and or a curiosity about how to show up in a way that touches and transforms the world as well as themselves. So I think that is standing in spiritual principle. That is the absolute way that I don't have to deny that someone's different. I don't have to have them fit into what I think they should be or how I think they should be. But I'm going to follow, you know, your advice, John, and really ask myself, am I being absolutely present to the presence of the divine in this person or in this community or in this experience with this person? So I am grateful. I am grateful in this very moment for you saying yes and for the wisdom you've shared and the humor along the way and for the ideas that you have presented, giving us all food for thought. Everyone who's listening, if you have not already visited stainedglassspirit.net, please go visit there. There is a link to a page where you can find all the recordings for the Intentionally Inclusive series and also a link to the Intentionally Inclusive Masterclass series, which is coming up really soon, by the end of the month of May. So if you're listening after May 2014, the Intentionally Inclusive Master Classes will be available for you to sign up for and to enhance your skills, your abilities, and get some new resources. Thanks so much, John. And until we talk again, everybody, just let your stained glass spirit shine. Thanks, John.
Bye-bye.